Thank you very much, Rebecca. That is like the best thing I've ever heard on this podcast. And it's not even on the podcast.
If anyone else has any intense fan gossip or secrets, please share them with Rebecca. And then she will dispense them. Because you're the guest, because nobody will get angry with you, because you just go back to Canada.
That's right.
It's fine.
Right.
You can leave people sobbing in the wake.
That's right.
Welcome to The Writer in the Thick, bi-monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. Hello, Ian. How are you?
I'm very good.
Would you like to tell the lovely people where?
Well, I was going to ask you.
Oh,
I know where we are. We're at Continuum 11. But what I was going to ask you was, how many live recordings have we done now?
I think this would be our fourth.
You sure?
I'm not sure. That's why I said I think.
Okay, you qualified.
Well, you didn't prepare
Jim
me.
Jim Hines, one. N.K. Jemison. Kat Valenti. I'm pretty sure we've done another one.
Alison Goodman.
That's five. You were wrong.
Okay, this is our fifth.
Okay.
Oh, that's a long time.
5 years worth of podcasting.
Anyway.
All these podcasts. Yes, hi. How are you, Kirsten? Do we have guests?
No, you definitely don't get enough airtime. That's quite clear. We have complaints about the lack of airtime for Ian Mott. So, no, we are here for those listening at home, which is most people. We are here at Continuum 11. And for our guests for this podcast, we have the lovely guests of honour of the convention, Tansy Rayner Roberts and RJ Anderson. How are you two both?
Good.
Enjoying the convention.
Yeah. Yes, we're having a lovely time, I think, so far. It's good.
Excellent, because it is Sunday afternoon of the convention, so it's already been going for quite a while. And more than enough
about
time.
About 3 weeks at this stage,
yes,
I think.
Yes, in con time, absolutely. I thought we would just start by, I'll give a brief biography of each of our lovely guests, and they can pop up and tell me if anything is wrong, because I consulted the internet, and as we all know, they're not necessarily 100% correct. So, Rebecca, I'm informed reliably or otherwise by the internet that you were born in Uganda.
Correct.
And how long did you live in Uganda before moving to Canada?
I was only there for a matter of months as a baby.
Okay, so do you still have Ugandan citizenship?
I don't have, no, I never did.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was born there in Kampala, but I don't remember any of it, but I grew up hearing my brother's stories.
And now you live in Ontario.
Yes.
And you've cited some of your authors of influence as being C.S. Lewis, Tolkien and E. Nesbitt.
Yes.
Ursula Le Guin, Patricia McKillop, and Robin McKinley. And you're now married and a mother of three. And you read your sons all of these works?
Yes.
And do they love them as much as you did?
They do. I'm actually currently reading an Australian author to my youngest son. I'm reading D.M. Cornish's Foundling.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. And I'm also told that your first novel, Knife, which was published in 2009, which is not that long ago, was longlisted for the Carnegie Award. And your 2012 novel, Ultraworld, was nominated for the Andre Norton Award. So congratulations for both of those.
Thank you.
And your new book will be out... Now, I've got fall of 2015, which I'm assuming is our
September,
spring.
September 2015.
Yes. And that will be called A Pocket Full of Murder.
Correct.
Which is one of the best titles I've heard in quite
a
while. It's lovely. And I'm hoping this is true, that you also wrote, used to write Doctor Who fan fiction.
I absolutely did. I still have a large page on fanfiction.net with all my fan fiction on
it. You may have already said this at other parts of the convention, but I haven't been here, so I'm going to ask anyway. Which Doctor would you gravitate towards?
Five. Five and 11
Davison.
Are my favourites.
Okay.
And I have a really soft spot for eight as well.
Okay, so you're five and which companions? This is all important, Kirsten.
So which companions?
Yeah.
Sarah Jane. Romana.
Five. No, but with five.
Oh, with five.
I want to get the exact spot in the continuity
as
to when you are writing.
Sorry.
So which stories are you fitting in between is what I want to understand.
My favourite companions of fives would probably be Tegan and Turlough.
I get it. I can see it. Yep, yeah. Good. No, that's cool. No, great. No, what? Don't give me that look, Kirsten. Keep
this
going.
This is what you do with your airtime?
No.
I'd like to thank Mondi for asking the questions that I really wanted to ask Rebecca and hadn't yet.
I was hoping that was a true fact when I saw that. So welcome, Rebecca. Thank you for being on our podcast.
Lovely to be here.
And our other lovely guest is Tansy Rayner Roberts from Hobart, as we all know Tansy from Galactic Suburbia, except Tansy's not in Hobart. She's in Melbourne.
I am in Melbourne. I'm pretty sure.
Which is very exciting.
Well, I know that I'm in Melbourne because I ate a zonut for breakfast. Apparently we can't have...
What?
It's a zonut.
What's that?
It is a cronut designed by Adriano Zumbo.
Okay.
It was the trendiest breakfast I've ever eaten.
Okay.
But he's from New South Wales. He's from Sydney.
His food is in Melbourne right now.
Okay. So obviously he hasn't crossed the ocean. Or the Tasman, or whatever you want to call that thing in between. No, okay. All right. Gotcha. What? I don't know our geography
was
that
it
well.
Good?
No, you don't.
It was really good. What was it exactly? I mean, you said a donut piped up.
It was a chocolate brownie flavoured cronut, which is a donut made out of croissant pastry. And it was filled with chocolate mousse.
You shitting me?
No.
A donut made out of croissant pastry? How does he get the texture?
He didn't invent the cronut. The cronut was already a thing.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
He just filled it with chocolate mousse.
And where do you acquire these things?
Yeah. Just across the road. There's like
that's
a
convenient.
I'll give you the instructions later.
Yeah, point me in
because
that direction.
The people listening, it will already have gone. It won't be there anymore. And the flavours, they change every week. Yeah, and the flavours change every week and then they're gone forever. So the people listening can already not buy this.
Oh, that's really sad.
But the people in the audience can go and get one straight after this recording.
Were you made aware of this? No, this is fascinating.
Well, partly because Elisa knows everything and it was on one of her life goals, but also we were lost in the Melbourne Emporium and we walked past it and there it was.
What do you mean it was one of her life goals? How long has this been around for? Why has my wife not told me? That was more interesting, actually, than the Davison Tegan Turlough. That was a bit
I'm sorry for derailing the podcast.
No, I think we should have done it just on the cronut. I want to know more about the history of the cronut. I didn't know croissant donut. How does that even go together? How?
Do you need a moment?
Yes. Yes.
Tansy, the internet also tells me, which I know is a true fact because I was there at the AussieCon in 1998 where you were announced as the winner of the publication competition for Splash Dance Silver.
You were there?
I was there.
It wasn't an AussieCon.
Wasn't it the WorldCon?
It was, I believe it was called Fan or FantasyCon. Oh. It was a one-day convention run at the Fantasia Bookshop, which was at the time run by Karen Miller, who went on to become a big Australian fantasy writer, but at the time was a bookseller.
It was a one-day convention. I was at WorldCon where they must have re-announced it. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of it.
That was the George Turner Prize, wasn't it?
So you also completed the Creature Court trilogy, which you were very happy about because third books of trilogies are not always a happening thing.
No. Some trilogies do not, in fact, have third books. Mm-hmm. So, the Creature Court trilogy was a bit of a milestone for me.
And you've recently edited The Cranky Ladies of History with Tahani of Fablecroft.
Yes. That is speaking of beautiful books.
And in addition to podcasting Galactic Suburbia and Verity and other occasional appearances, you've been writing a lot of fan writing recently in the last couple of years.
Yes.
So much so that you won a Hugo Award.
I did. It's very shiny and very pointy. And lives on my kitchen dresser.
I'm told that you're also the first Australian woman to win a Hugo.
Yes, I am. Helen told me that, though I assumed that it's true. She did, in fact. Yeah, Helen Merrick screamed it at me.
And that's
so
total,
I assume it to be true.
That's total Hugo's, not just Hugo's
total
fan writer.
Total Hugo's first Australian woman, yes.
Is that normally how Helen talks to you? Or is she just more polite?
Isn't that how she talks to you, everyone?
Yeah.
Depends on how excited she is. She was very excited.
Oh, this I assume is on Twitter via caps lock, not actually at the ceremony.
No, it was on the phone.
Oh, it was on the phone.
It was very loud.
It'd be hilarious if it was at the actual ceremony, if you just got up for no reason. I just screamed out.
I wasn't at the ceremony.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't make it to that one.
Yeah.
And the one thing the internet / your own website did not tell me was what you're currently working on, because down the bottom it was dated 2013. So I thought I should ask you in person what you're currently working on or what's just about to be published, perhaps.
I'm three chapters away from finishing my manuscript of Musketeer Space.
Ah, yes.
Which is my gender-swapped space opera retelling of The Three Musketeers, which I've been publishing as a web serial. So I'm a couple of months away from finishing publishing it as a serial, but I'm three chapters away from finishing it. And I will be sending it to my agent, so it is potentially actually going to be properly published as well as web serial published, but that, depends on a lot of things.
And how's Livia Day going?
Livia Day.
I hear you know Livia well.
I do. Livia Day, who is the crime author who lives inside my head and drinks all the tea, she actually has a short story out. We have this new, there are two books in my crime series. as Livia Day. But we've just released, or about to release, a digital short story, The Blackmail Blend, which is currently available as digital ARC, published on the back of a box of tea. So you buy the box of tea and it has a download code and you can go download the short story.
That is very cool.
I think that's cooler than the cronut thing.
Well, you know, you can make
the cronut and the tea together.
Yes.
The tea and the cronut. We haven't yet figured out how to get a cronut to download a short story for you. It's actually from a small Tasmanian tea company called The Art of Tea, and they have their own, they have beautiful, beautifully branded tea, and they will sell wholesale tea and brand it, like rebrand it for you with stickers and labelling, which they do for weddings and that sort of thing. And as soon as I saw it, I thought, ooh, book promotion. So 12th Planet Press has now become a tea merchant as well as a bookseller.
Excellent. And Rebecca, so you write under R.J. Anderson.
That's right.
I'm always interested when writers choose different or variations on their full name to write under. What was the reason for writing under initials?
When I was growing up, initials were a thing writers did. You know, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, E. Nesbitt. You know, so it was both men and women that I was familiar with who had initials. And so I thought, oh, initials are writerly. And I like my initials. R.J. Anderson sounds good. So from, like, you know, my early teens, I thought it would be cool to write as R.J. Anderson. And then, you know, I got married, and my married name was of a sort that was hard for people to pronounce correctly and would also cause teenagers to giggle. So I decided to stick with Anderson. Yeah, so some people have said, well, were you trying to hide that you're a woman? Did you think that would increase your sales? And I'm like, literally, that never occurred to me. I just like the look of my initials.
So it's just the literary effect of having the initials.
Yeah, the literary effect
name.
Of the initials, yeah.
Nice, very nice. Do you find now that the name that you write under in Tansy, you might also address this? Because that's not your name that you go by day to day, do you find there's like a separation between yourself as Rebecca and R.J. Anderson?
Well, I mean, I certainly know when people know me from my work and not from real life, they call me R.J. No one in real life who knows me calls me R.J. They all call me Rebecca. So I know if somebody calls me R.J. that, okay, they know me from some sort of, you know, writing-related context. But other than that, no, I feel very much, I mean, it was the name I grew up with. It just happens to be the initials. So if I had chosen a pen name that was farther removed and more sort of fanciful, then I might feel more of a disconnect. But it's me. It's me in my working hat, you know?
And Tansy, you're talking about the writer who lives inside your head.
Yeah. Livia Day kind of does my head in. I didn't realize how much it actually would affect my, I guess, sense of writing identity to have a different... But I start thinking about who Livia is and how she thinks and how she presents. It's like, no, it's me! So, I don't know. I don't know if I would make that choice again. I think it was a good decision to try and separate the science fiction and the crime aspect. I very rarely am in situations where people call me Livia. I've had a couple of, like, festival invites or events where I'm there as Livia Day. There was one memorably where I was invited to be on one panel as Tansy and one as Livia. And I thought, okay, I'll get into this different mindset. And then, like, I met my fellow panelists and they're like, it's Tansy, really, isn't it? It's like, yeah, it is. So I don't quite feel like Livia. But yeah, as Rebecca was saying, you know, when I am in a situation where people call me Livia, I definitely know that I am there working and this is not, you know, this is very much the author thing. But I kind of have that to some extent when I'm Tansy too, but I can be a bit more relaxed about it. So I don't know. I'm still figuring it out.
That's interesting. You should buy Livia a hat.
Yeah, we've talked about like scarves and hats and things. I deliberately chose the name Livia because I needed a name that if somebody said it behind me, I would react to it. And because I did my PhD thesis on Roman imperial women, Livia is one of those names. If I hear it, I'll think, that's a cool name because... very few people are called Livia, and I would totally notice if anybody had that name. In retrospect, I probably should have got something even lower. Like, I don't think Agrippina would have quite worked. I'd like to point out as well, the first time I had a crisis of confidence about the Livia Day name was because Mondi came up to me at a convention and said, why did you do the Livia Day thing? And I immediately forgot all the sensible reasons why I had, and I'm just like, I don't know.
Did I do that?
Yes.
I've never done that before.
You totally did that to me.
Oh, okay. Well,
we had a really intense conversation about it, and we're going, I don't know, have I made a terrible mistake?
I had an intense conversation?
No, I think I was intense. Okay. I think you were just asking difficult questions.
Yeah, well.
Because you never, ever do that.
No, never.
You never interrogate people.
No, well, I'm sorry. I apologise.
No, no, that's okay. I think it was the crisis of confidence I needed to have. I'm all right now.
Well, should we go into the books or?
I was just about to go into the books.
Okay,
you preempted me.
No, no, sorry. You're running the podcast very well. Keep going.
Thank you.
That wasn't patronising.
It was a little patronising.
No, it wasn't.
So we're going to move on and discuss the two books that have been chosen for the podcast, and as has become tradition for these live recordings that we do, normally, as listeners will know, Ian and I each choose a book that we recommend to the other, and then we talk about them. When we have guests on, we ask them to choose a book that they like. So we might start with Rebecca's choice, and which is The King of Atolia by Megan Whalen-Turner. And Rebecca, do you want to just tell us why you chose this particular book?
The King of Atolia is a book that, like, frankly blew my mind. I had been told by many friends of mine who knew I loved fantasy, knew my tastes, that I really had to read The Thief, the very first book in this series by Megan Whalen-Turner. It had won a Newbery Honor, you know, so it was well regarded. And I put it off for the longest time because I thought, oh, you know, a book called The Thief, I can just see what it's going to be about. It's going to be, you know, medieval, wisecracking thief, gets into trouble, has some kind of adventure. I've read books like that before. You know, how special can this one be? So I put it off for quite a long time. And then I finally, you know, got bored enough to pick it up. And and I was really amazed that it was not at all what I had thought it would be, that the setting was completely different. It was set in kind of a world based on sort of Byzantine Greece and the Mediterranean. It had myths woven into the story, this sort of pantheon of invented gods. But the myths felt, they rang very true. They felt very much like the Greek and Roman myths that I had read growing up as a child. And the story had this amazing twist, which I didn't see coming, and yet was one of these things that made perfect sense in retrospect, which is a hard thing for writers to pull off. And I respected that book. I didn't love it. I thought it was good. But I already had The Queen of Atolia, the second book, from the library, so I thought I would read that. Well, that one took the top off my head because, again, she took everything that I thought I knew about her world and her characters, and she changed everything. And then I was eager to read the third book, The King of Atolia, and again, like, she just turned everything upside down again. She puts you in the head of a character that you've never met before, from a perspective you've never seen before, and it gives you a whole new perspective on all the characters. And one of the things I thought was really interesting about this series is that, oh, even though it is a series and the books are linked, you can read sort of each one independently, and it does stand as a complete story in itself. She gives you what you need to know what's going on in the story, but of course it's much richer if you have read the whole series. Now, the reason for her having to do this, perhaps she would have done it anyway, but she has an inordinately long time between books because she is such a thorough and careful writer, and she works very slowly and painstakingly to construct these books. And I think that's one of the reasons that her fans are so ardent, because they can see the craftsmanship that went into these books. But they take her anywhere from, I think the largest gap she's had between books has been like 8 years.
8 years?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, so she's, you know, her books are 4 years apart at the least, sometimes six, sometimes eight. So, yeah, so it's something you have to wait for a long time, which is difficult when you're writing ostensibly for children. You know, the Newbery Honor, it was technically middle grade, but her characters are like adults, and they are interacting in a very adult world. They're very unusual books in a lot of ways. They break a lot of the rules of children's literature, and a lot of the people I know who love them are, in fact, adults.
And here's my complete ignorance about writing, in any case. They're not that long. I mean,
no.
They're only about 85,000-90,000 words.
Yeah.
But yet takes that long to write. So,
yeah.
And that's the background research around the sort of Byzantine
era that she's reflecting. Yeah, the research and just the construction of sort of the political machinations and the nuances. She says, She has said in her books about her process that she tries to remove anything that is telling the reader something they could conceivably deduce for themselves. So part of her process is going through the book and removing all the things that are crutches or you know, she assumes her readers are smart, basically. And so she is always letting them intuit things, letting them guess at things and figure things out. And so, yeah, I don't know all the details of why her process takes so long, but I'm happy with the result. So,
could either of you stretch it out for that long? Again, showing complete lack of ignorance on writing, but I'm just curious. It's always...
I think you underestimate how long authors can sometimes as in, you know, you could, absolutely. It's not hard to take a really long time to write a book. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, I think...
Well, if you're playing video games in the meantime, yeah, I can see. But I'm saying
I love how you're really trying hard here not to say something horribly tactless.
No, I'm not trying that hard. But anyway, yeah, no.
I think every writer has different methods. It depends on how much time you have to write and how much time you take with the process. It's completely different for everybody. And it's really interesting because you cannot tell by an end result of any book how much time an author put into it. There's often the thing you hear people talking about books like, oh, they obviously wrote that one too fast. And it's like, yeah. How do you know?
Yeah.
You don't know how many hours in the day that they wrote, physically spent writing. You don't know how much time they spent thinking about it. You know, it's like, because sometimes authors actually get criticised if they bring books out too quickly.
Yes.
There's that as well, where there's this idea that, like, people think they can see into the process. But no, some books just take as long as they take. I don't know. I don't know how other people do it.
I just thought you all, you know, sent little notes to each other. Yeah. About...
Well, we do, but not about that.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Well, but you also don't know, as Tansy said, you like 8 years between a book, but you don't know how much time in that 8 years a writer spends actually writing.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
yeah.
If there's full-time work involved, if there's
child
rearing
involved. Health
issues
can intervene as well.
If there's a health issue or if you're having to care for someone with a health issue. I think a mistake that a lot of people can make who talk about time, whether it's too short or too long between people producing books, is assuming that the writer is spending every minute of every day writing the book. So therefore, how can they not have it written in only a year? Why has it taken George R. R. Martin so long?
I knew you were going to bring up George R. R. Martin. That's what, I probably shouldn't have asked the question.
Because you are then assuming that that's what they're doing all day, every day.
Yeah, no, good point.
And for the most part, unless a writer is open about what else is happening in their life, you have no idea how much of that 8 years was spent writing this book. Maybe, you know, time-wise, actual time in front of the computer, it was 6 months.
Yep.
But maybe they had to think about it for the 6 years first.
Right. Mm. Well, and there's always the possibility of false starts, too. And I think I know one writer who says that her process involves writing a draft completely wrong, the wrong plot, the wrong characters, the wrong everything. And then she writes another draft where maybe she gets the plot right, but the main character is wrong. And so she has to write another draft where she figures out who the main character should be. And, like, oh, that would drive me insane, but that's her process.
Yeah, okay. And there weren't books in between these that... came out. No, I'm not trying to dig a hole here. I'm saying that there wasn't a set of... Because I think she's written more than just these three books in this series.
Well, she her first book was a collection of short stories called Instead of Three Wishes. And then she wrote The Thief, which got her all the attention. And then everything she's written since, she's got four books in that series of a projected six. So she's working on the fifth one now. But it's only been that series. She hasn't.
Okay.
She's written a couple of short stories in that same world, but other than that, nothing.
So, what did you think of the book, Ian?
Yeah, I didn't like it. Sorry. It's funny how you threw that at me.
I did throw that at you because...
I'm not joking, by the way. I've got reasons why.
Yeah.
It's funny you say... One of the things that you said that really struck me is you said that she goes through and removes the crutches.
Yeah.
I felt that there were too many crutches in this novel.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And
that's coming from a guy who's not read the first two books. Mm. You were the same?
Yeah, I think identical to you when you said that. It was like, huh? Because that was
you're not going to like us at the end of this.
I will say straight up that regardless of how this book was written, this is not an ideal Kirsten book for those who've been listening to the podcast. And books which are not Kirsten books, for reasons of content and theme and so on, just have to work that much harder to interest me. So there's that. It's just not a book for me. And we all have those books. But one of the things that just did irritate me throughout the whole book of it was that I did feel there was so much exposition in terms of what characters were thinking and why they were thinking it. And joining of dots between action even and dialogue and why a character sat down heavily and those sort of things. And it made me really think about how, as a reader, I engage with just text on a page. And for me, I mean, one of the old stalwarts of writing advice is show, don't tell. And I'm not a huge advocate of a lot of rules and guidelines. I think, as with rules of grammar, as with a lot of rules, it's really important to understand the underlying reasons that these rules and guidelines came about. Not necessarily to follow them, but you need to understand them in order to know when you can ignore them. And the reason I think so many people go on about show, don't tell, show, don't tell, show, don't tell, is that at its base, it comes from the idea that cognitively you need to engage the reader's mind with what they're reading. If you tell them everything and join all the dots and explain why characters say things or do things or think things, the mind doesn't have to work. It just has to listen. And that's probably the primary reason why show, don't tell has become one of these kind of chestnuts of writing advice. And with The King of Atolia, I really did feel that there was just so much telling. And for me, I kind of skated over the top of this book all the time, which did make me sad. And I also think that the fact that it was the third book, I didn't know how much of what I was feeling was exposition was necessary because I hadn't read two books. So obviously there's a certain amount of backstory and filling in of details and history that needs to be given. And for readers who've read the other two, it would be like a refresher. Oh, that's right. And then it would actually link you back into the book you'd already read, and it would sort of make those scenes more alive. Whereas for I don't know if you found this, Ian, but for someone who hadn't read those two books, it just felt like a lot of drag on the narrative.
Interesting.
And also, obviously, not having read the other two books about these characters, I wasn't getting any of the resonance of those characters.
I wasn't invested. I know what you're saying. I think, though, what's fascinating is that Eugenides, we both had this because we did discuss this prior to the podcast. We cheated a little bit.
There may have been a couple of texts back
yes.
and forth.
We neither of us figured. I think I figured it before you did, because I didn't read. I didn't even look at the other two in terms of Wikipedia entries and that Eugenides is the main character,
yes.
ostensibly.
Yes.
Now
you get him in first person in The Thief.
Yeah.
And then the Queen of Atolia shifts into third person. Of the story of Eugenides.
Neither was it clear to me until much later that he and the Queen actually are in love with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
well, because it's not clear to Costas.
No, but see, and this yeah. is so this is the double-edged sword here. It's a really clever move to, yeah. in a sense, to go through the eye of a character we've never seen before. But for someone who's reading it for the first time, it's all that investment that you have brought in, because you already know who this guy is.
Fair enough, yeah.
And you also know that he actually has this romance with. They actually love each other, which is an odd thing in this world. Thanks. And also there's this god. The whole thing about the god, the god of the thieves,
yes.
is this little thing at the very end, which I'm going to guess was a much bigger thing in at least the first book.
Mm-hmm.
It's made a big deal. Where in the third book, it's Ephicostus, and actually one of the few parts of the novels that genuinely engaged with me when Costas sees him essentially walk off off the what are they called
the parapet.
Parapet, yeah. Walk off and then be standing
the god catches him. Yeah.
The god catches him. Yeah, which I thought that was fantastic. But possibly would have worked better if maybe not. I don't know. And again,
if you knew that was a possibility in the world.
Well, right. Yes.
Which in this book is the first time that actually there's any indication that the gods are any more
than just
present interventionist than just as we think about
I can
about
see the problem, and now I can see that it was a poor book to choose.
No. It's a good, no, don't, please, God, don't go that way. Don't.
No. What I mean is, it's true. I mean, me having read the previous two books, yes, there is all that resonance, and there is a lot of sort of subtle nuances from those first two books which come into play in the third book. And I thought, you know, well, because you have a new narrator, and he's kind of new to Eugenides and Atolia and to this entire setup, he can be the gateway for a new new reader to come into the series in that book and kind of get what's going on, because Costas is gradually getting what's going on. But you're right. I think you're quite right about the lack of resonance if you don't know those details.
Yeah.
And that just finding them out with Costas is not enough. It's, you really need to know them as a reader going in so you can be like, oh, I can't wait till Costas finds this out.
Well, that's it. I think you...
That's good. So you're thinking, there's a revelation coming that he doesn't...
What we are missing is, like, I'd imagine for Costas, who thinks the king and queen hate each other, we're missing the knowledge...
Or that it was a marriage of convenience.
And I think that's where the exposition comes in, like, because it's exposition to Costas, basically, or for us to understand, you know, sort of where Costas is coming from. So it's so that it makes sense that he understands what's going on.
Is the punch off screen, or is it at the end of the second book?
The witch?
The punch. The Costas punches the Eugenides. And that's what starts this whole thing.
I think it's on screen that he hits.
Not in this book. It doesn't start with.
Oh, okay. Well, so for some reason, I don't know why I thought that.
Did you really?
No, he thinks about it in the course of the book. He thinks about how it happened, but we don't actually see it happen. Yeah,
but the punch didn't happen at the end of the previous book.
No. Okay. No, Costas is not a character until this book. This is the first time you meet Costas or learn anything about him.
I did think that choosing Costas as her primary, he's not her only point of view character, but her primary point of view character was a really interesting and bold authorial move to be telling the story about the king and queen outside their inner circle, so to speak. And I thought that was a really interesting approach. And I hear what you're saying about him becoming an introductory character for new readers as well. I guess I almost wish that she had just kept him as the point of view character, because she did bring in these little side.
Well, that was my issue, that Costas, she doesn't sustain it with Costas for the whole novel. She does go outside the kingdom entirely with a couple of scenes that actually made zero sense to me, I'll be honest, but I assume have resonance to people beyond that. And then we actually get stuff from from Eugenides' point of view and from the Queen's point of view to a lesser extent. And again, I thought, if this is your plan to actually introduce us via Costas, then we should have just sat with Costas. I know it would have been a tougher game to pull off, given some of the stuff that happens two-thirds of the way through the book. But, it means that it's an experiment that hasn't... Well, experiment's probably not the right word, but technique that she hasn't followed through for me.
Well, and I wonder how much of that is editorial guidance as well, because I get the feeling that Megan Whelan Turner would very much like to sort of, you know, have her books be one story. But because of the huge gap between books, I can very well imagine her editor saying to her, look, Megan, you can't do this. You've got to bring the new readers on board, because you are getting a lot of new readers, because you know, the other ones have all grown up. And, you know, you have some loyal adult fans, but we would like to sell this book to younger readers as well, so you need to bring them in somehow.
But what's going on in those little sections in the other kingdom? There's some.
Are we talking about the Medes?
No, the I think
it may be from Eugenides' homeland.
Edis. Sorry. Yeah. So that's, you know, Eugenides' home country.
Yeah, and so that's just a touchstone back to
his home.
But is there stuff actually of importance going on there that's happening parallel to the events of this book?
I mean, basically you have this, you know, these three kingdoms gradually moving together politically to confront what is going to be the threat of the Mede Empire coming in and taking them over, and the greater powers of the continent. So she is setting you up for a gigantic war. And she's gradually, you know, bringing forward these alliances that have to happen in order for these kingdoms to survive. So you see that gradually developing over the course of the books. It comes into play much more so in the fourth book, A Conspiracy of Kings. So, she takes you from what seems like a very small story of one thief who, you know, is in the king's prison and he gets an opportunity to get out if he can only steal this stone. Turns out, you know, the stone is more important than anyone, you know, let on, and it's got political ramifications. So she's steadily opening up this political world and making it more and more complex. And for me, one of the chief joys of the series is seeing what insane plan Eugenides has got up his sleeve with every given book. And it's like, you know, how is he going to pull this off? Or what is he trying to pull off? What is the...
Okay, so sorry. I know Tansy wants to jump in, but I just want to just say one little thing. The bit where See, this is where this difference between you and I would have been. The bit where the Queen says, but you said it would take 3 months or whatever it was, 180 days to knock off, you know, to get to bring out the conspiracy that's going on, and you've done it in 60 days. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of gone, oh, well, that's how good I am. That's the sort of thing where the long-time fan would have gone, woohoo, he's so bloody good, where I'm going, you're an arrogant prick and I want to smack you really hard.
Yeah, Jen is eminently smackable, but he is also eminently lovable. So, I mean, but yes, I think I can see how a lot of that plays in from the first couple of books. When I was reading these books to my kids, my son's first reaction to Jen's antics in a lot of The Thief was kind of like, he's such a brat, but I like him, you know?
Yeah.
That they get like, I can't believe he said that. I can't believe he did that. I can't believe he's being such a brat. And that, I mean, that's, you either like that or you don't, I think. So if you love Jen, you love the books. If you find him, you know, an arrogant jerk, then I can see.
I suppose because I haven't got that background yet.
That's what I'm saying. You know, like, okay, I thought it might be a good book to discuss. Maybe not so much. But it may be that it wouldn't have been your cup of tea anyway. But
Tansy, what did you think of the book?
I liked it so much more than I thought I would. I read Queen of Atolia some years ago, largely because this series is so well regarded and I've heard so many people recommending it. I think it came to me overhyped. I was also told the whole thing about you can read them as individual books. And I read the second one and spent a lot of time not knowing what was going on.
Mm, fair enough.
Yeah, no, I liked elements of Queen of Atolia, but not enough to keep reading. I liked King of Atolia a lot more. And I only vaguely remembered stuff from before, so I had that, I probably mixed different experience of knowing some of what's going on and not. I think I like Jen better as a character, as what he is in this novel, who's effectively an antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And I found him more interesting and likeable, I guess, as an antagonist, because I didn't have to like him, if that makes sense, because he is so frustrating.
Yes.
And I like the fact that Costas is really frustrated with him, so I it took me a while to get into the swing of the book because it is a very different pace than you normally get in pretty much any other book ever. It very feels true. Like something that's written in the 19th century in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's got a slower pace, a sort of gentler tone. So it took me a while to get into the swing of it. But I appreciated the fact that it was quite a small story.
Mm-hmm.
I like that it's very domestic. And it's just really, it's basically this one guy who has a terrible boss. And the mystery of who this boss is, and it's effectively done as if, and I know it must be very frustrating for you guys, and there's a lot of stuff that revealed later on, like the relationship and stuff, but I kind of like that the relationship between the king and the queen is revealed as a mystery, and because the fact that it's a secret is important, because there's that whole thing where, yes, they are in love, and yes, it is a marriage of convenience, and there's this whole problem of the king having married into this kingdom and where he's hated, because he came and literally stole the queen, which was a bit I remember from a previous book.
Yes.
Everybody in the kingdom hates him. It's a very similar narrative we normally have in history as well as in literature generally with the incoming queen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the Marie Antoinette story, the queen, or Anne of Austria. It's the queen who comes from a country they hate or are at war with, who marries the king and has a horrible time at the court because everybody treats her like crap. Only it's being told with a man, and he comes in, he marries the queen, and everyone's like, well, this is the king, but obviously he's not our king. And there's this hint very strongly throughout that if it was widely known that the king and queen loved each other, particularly that she loved him, her people would lose respect for her.
Yes.
Mm.
So she's actually... So the fact that there's this whole mystery where he bars his door every night and there's this suspicion, like Costa starts to suspect that he's depressed or that like there's problems going on. He's actually sneaking off to the queen's bed every night.
He's sneaking into the tunnels, yes.
But that's actually a massive state secret. Mm. Like if everyone knew that the king and queen really loved each other, it would probably help the king's reputation, but it would severely
diminish
hers. Yeah. And she could potentially, there's always this hint that she could even lose her kingdom over it. And so I found all that stuff and all the quiet domestic rumblings, like the fact that the king's attendants all treated him terribly and everybody hated him. I know, I found it quite enjoyable just to see him suffer, frankly. all this, the ink-stained shirts and everything. But it has that very, I think because it's such a pared-down writing style, which is not my preferred writing or reading style at all. I'm all for putting lots of more stuff on the page. But it felt almost like reading a fairy tale or a myth.
Yes. I think myth is what she's going for.
Book.
Yeah.
So it has that slightly distancing thing where the characters feel a lot like they're almost archetypes rather than people. which again, not something I would normally identify with at all, but I kind of started, once I kind of felt like I was getting the hang of it, I could read it. Because, you know, I've read a lot of very old books, and I do like the fact that there's this use of Greek mythological fairyland, I guess, as the setting. I always like it when there's something other than medieval England is the setting.
Yes.
Or, yeah, medieval France, you know. So I like that element. But, yeah, it does have a very distancing tone. I think it's really fascinating that these are marketed so effectively as children's books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something I didn't realise till I read it, and then I went away and researched around the book. It's like, this is YA?
Because
yeah.
It's really? So rare. It's actually a very old-fashioned kind of children's book in that sense, because...
And all the characters are these adults, days, and yeah. It's political and...
These days you do not tend to find YA books who have adult main characters. But it actually used to be a lot more common for children's classics to be about adult heroes, but, you know, it was aimed at a younger audience. And now it's almost assumed that if you publish a book, the protagonist will be 18 months to 3 years older than your reader. You know, this almost really precise thing.
Well, it's mandated, in fact, you would say. Not
but
even
every
just
now
assumed.
And then you have an author who comes... And so the fact that this... Not only that they're YA, but the fact that they continue to be marketed as YA, despite the fact that obviously her working method is not sympathetic to being a children's author, her style is so atypical for a children's author. Mm. But I guess the Newbery probably just messed it up in the sense that, you know, it's like, well, now you've just got to write for children forever.
I think very much so.
And it's something kind of similar that we've seen in Australia, very different writer, but with Margot Lanigan's career. Because Margot basically is known as a YA author. An awful lot of her stuff does not necessarily have traditional YA tropes or,
Tender
characters.
Morsels.
Yeah, and there's something like Tender Morsels comes out and everybody gets really distressed. You know, everybody's a little bit traumatised still by Tender Morsels. That's okay. But just this idea, it's like, what is a YA book? And it makes you start asking these questions. Does it have to be about teenagers? Does it have to be about a specific age group? I think it's the idea of adult books with adults as the central character. I mean, the fact that this is basically a domestic story in which one of the central revelations is about, you know, the marital relationship of the king and the queen. And, like, trouble at work, it's like the ancient Greek version of The Office at times.
It's true, it is.
Yeah,
it's
and just the idea that this is like being marketed at, what is the range? Is it like YA or children's? Is it like being marketed at 10-year-olds or 15-year-olds?
Well,
or is
the Thief, as I said, was, you know, won the Newbery. So it was marketed at like 8 to 12-year-olds.
Yeah. Wow.
Since then, they have had to go up. I think The Queen of Atolia was still considered middle grade. Yeah. I think they've had to go up with From the King of Atolia, and definitely A Conspiracy of Kings was labelled as 12 to 18.
Because The Thief is the one in which she cuts his hand off, right?
No, that's The Queen of Atolia. At the beginning of The Queen of Atolia, that's the twist that changes everything.
That's the twist, because, you know, I know we're allowed to spoil all the things. We could spoil the earlier books too, I assume. So, yeah, The Thief is the whole... And then, The Queen of Atolia, I remember that.
Yeah.
So he cuts his own hand? I thought they tortured him.
No, the Queen. He's a thief.
Yeah.
She catches the thief. She cuts his hand off. They end up getting married.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this is one of the things that I and other fans of the books really love, and I know that sounds terribly twisted, but the fact that you have this love story between this guy and the woman who cut off his hand, and
that was his thieving hand, wasn't it?
Well, he's still got one left. That's a thieving hand too, but, you know.
Yeah. But, you know, the fact is you have this sort of psychological complexity to their relationship in the fact that he both loves and is terrified of her. And also that, you know, their roles are, you know, in terms of sort of, you know, gender roles, they are reversed in many ways. That she is the strong, terrible, much admired ruler of her kingdom for whom all of her soldiers would gladly die. And he is the vain, peacock-like, despised, frivolous, foppish figure who they can't figure out, you know, like, okay, well, he must have gotten the better of her in, you know, in that respect that he forced her to marry him, but we don't have to like it. So, yeah, I mean, I find their relationship to be fascinating, and because I do love Jen, and if you don't love Jen, it's hard to like the series, admittedly. But there's a lot of parallels between these books and Dorothy Dunnett's Lyman Chronicles. Has anyone read the Lyman books?
No, I haven't.
Okay, they are a definite influence. Francis Crawford of Lyman is another very polarizing character. You either love him or you hate him. But you have a similar sort of sprawling complexity of historical, I mean, in Megan Whelan-Turner's case, it's pseudo-historical, but Dorothy Dunnett's books are actual history. So you have this sort of sprawling thing. And you have this character who does appalling things and is sometimes very unlikable. And then when you find out his actual motives for doing what he's doing, you kind of go from like, ah, Francis, to, oh, Francis. And if you like having your emotions manipulated in that way, and if you like, you know, being tricked in that way, then you like the books. And if you don't, you don't.
See, for me, Eugenides doesn't do anything particularly appalling. He's just, for a good reason, very distant. And he doesn't, I mean, he could have treated his attendants with a lot more, well, he could have smacked them around, frankly. Yeah. He's actually quite patient with them in many ways. And that's actually what shat me. It was more that, again, probably because I didn't understand the universe so well, why doesn't he just tell these guys to stop piss-farting around with him? Stop.
Well, it's part of his... That's the thing. That's part of his plan, to be underestimated, to be seen as...
Yes, that's what I got, and I got that. But it wasn't that he was doing appalling stuff or doing things that were prickish by nature.
Yeah.
It was more that he was not proactive, but we find out that he actually has been.
Yeah.
But that's what set my teeth on edge. I suppose the other thing that annoyed me was, two things. One is, actually a question. Why does the Queen faint? Because the point's made there's a point made in the actual scene, the Queen would never faint.
Not at the sight of blood, but it's his blood. And she is forever haunted by the fact that she cut off his head.
See, that made zero. That just seemed like a bad feminist moment, if I were to put it.
No, there's very good reasons for it. And again, this probably goes back to having read Queen of Atolia. But the fact is that she was put into a position where she felt that politically she had no choice but to cut off his hand or else kill him. And she actually goes through sort of the whole he haunts her, the guilt of it. And she thinks, okay, maybe I should have killed him.
Do you know why? Sorry, I just want to jump in. Do you know why I had a problem for it? Because we're told, and this is the point, we're told so often that she's dangerous, etc. You know, could chop off your head at a moment's notice because she's that sort of person.
That's the reputation she's cultivated.
But it's not. This book doesn't actually do much with it because, as you say, Tansy, it's very domesticated. So there aren't really opportunities. Other than the fact that when he has an assassination attempt, she gets pissed off with his guards and wants to fire them all. But, you know, bugger it. I would have done the same. It's not...
Wants to kill them all.
Well,
it's a fairly important distinction.
Yeah, true. True, but I expect that a queens and king...
This is the thing which I think is really interesting.
Then she faints, and that's why... I don't understand.
I think an alternate reading could also be she faints because it's his blood and she loves him and that's part of that revelation.
Well,
so you don't necessarily need that background. Yeah. But I think that it's a story of kings and queens. I think we're not used to reading about a male character who has so little agency.
Mm-hmm.
I find this interesting. He does... There's a very little that he spends a lot of time not doing things in this book. It's very frustrating. And it's not what we're used to seeing. But a lot of what he's doing as well is trying to kind of demonstrate an alternative to a world in which violence is the only way to enact power.
Mm.
And it's very clear, like, her response to a lot of the stuff done by their servants and people working for them and people that they trust and advisors is, well, at this point you've got to chop somebody's head off. And he's trying not to rule like that, which is fascinating because it's questioning the nature of power. If your only power, your only form of punishment is to kill, then what happens if you stop? It's almost like a super nanny kind of thing, where it's trying to find alternate methods of punishing and trying to take control without actually using violence to do so in a world that has always associated power with violence. And so the fact that he's trying to find alternative, the fact that there's a whole storyline about pardoning the advisor who obviously thinks he's going to be killed, the fact that Jen is going out of his way to... Like, with the attendants, he could have solved that problem on day one, and he would have solved that problem by sending them to the stocks or sending them to prison or whatever. He had that power, but he didn't want the power to make things happen by being a more and more brutal king.
Well, and part of it is that those attendants are part of his grand plan.
Yeah.
He is actually plotting to overthrow the whole house of yeah. one
of
those attendants.
Out all the,
yeah. Yeah. So it
so
wasn't
he's
a problem
setting them up,
to be
he's
solved.
Maneuvering.
It was part
he's,
of...
Yeah. He's yeah. putting the yeah. pieces in place. And if he does that for his own sake, then he loses those pawns in this game that he's playing. But one of the yeah one of the crucial things about Eugenides is that the books are basically about the gods maneuvering him into a position he does not want to be in, which is basically to be emperor. He does not want to be king of Aetolia. Originally, he only becomes king because he wants Aetolia, because he loves her. So he ends up being king and leaving behind his very beloved country of Edis, which is very hard and depressing for him, because of her. And then in his position as king and as the one who loves her, he feels it is his responsibility, he wants to help her to cement her power and to make sure that she stays in power and that her own guard doesn't overthrow her. And that's sort of at the core of this book, what he's trying to do to make it not possible for her own army to rise up against her and overthrow her. And he also doesn't want to be the reason for them doing that. But again and again, you have him fighting the idea of being the one in charge. And she is perfectly secure in her power. She is willing to share power with him, and he keeps trying to get away from it and say, no, you do the ruling. You know, I will be your king, but I don't want to have the power. But he just keeps getting pushed into that position.
Oh.
So again, that's very unusual for a male character. It's not what you usually see, but I like that about the books.
Oh, I don't know. I think the story of the reluctant king is a very it's one that I have less and less patience for. Actually, as I grow older, the idea that yes, the reluctant king.
He wants it, but he doesn't want to want it.
Yeah.
I think because he knows that if he takes it, he could become terrible.
And I think one of the things that did annoy me about by the time I got to the end of the book was if I'm reading it right, and I realize that this series is about it's about this character, it's his series, so it makes sense that this would be the case. So his whole thing is to be. To become king and to be accepted as king on his own terms and ruling in his way. And it seems like when he becomes accepted as king, he is then elevated above the queen. So it's the old monarchical structure of you can have a queen, but only if there's not a king, which is why we have Prince Philip, because you cannot be a king if there is a queen. And that's like, why? Why would someone who marries the queen, who is the in situ monarch, just because he's male, gets to be elevated above her? And again, I realize it's his story, so that's why. But it was that little thing of like, why does she have to step aside just because he happens to be her husband instead of her wife, as it were?
It's fascinating the power that the word king has.
Mm.
And it's something that we have seen through history in the way people dealing with it, like the fact that if a queen marries a man, he becomes the king. Somehow king seems to outweigh queen.
It does. That's
it
like
is a word
usually,
in our culture.
Yeah.
But still, if a woman marries a king, she still gets to be a queen because a queen always is seen as one step below.
Yeah,
there's a lot of examination in this book to a extent of the meaning of the word king and what king means to people. Everybody expects him to come in and immediately be a step above her, and that he actually doesn't want that,
no.
not just because – and the fact that it's being given to him despite of that is kind of annoying. I agree, absolutely. And in the same way that the fact that this particular one focuses on Costas's point of view means we don't get much of Aetolia, and she is a really interesting character, and she's quite distant in this book. But I do think it is a really interesting question, that thing of should somebody, you know, of whether a king is worth more than a queen, especially in this particular setup, because we have two countries ruled by queens, don't
yes.
we?
Yes. There's a queen of Edis.
Yeah, Edis yeah. also, which means that Jen has already basically pre-learned to be subservient to a queen
yes.
before his marriage.
Mm, yeah.
And that he would be quite happy to be prince consort.
Absolutely.
You get that impression. He'd,
absolutely.
You know, no responsibility. He'd get to wear the shirts without the ink stains, maybe, and stuff like that.
And no one would put yeah. sand in his food.
He's yeah. being forced, and effectively it's implied that he's being forced to be king by Aetolia, that is
yes.
her choice.
Yes.
Which it's like, you know.
She sees the political expediency.
Which doesn't
putting
mean
him
that
in
it's
that
a
position.
Feminist choice just because it's a choice that the queen is
no.
making.
And it just did make me sad that.
Yeah.
This is, I guess, another world loosely based on worlds we know, where certain underlying structures, such as is a monarchy a good thing? And it, even within that monarchy, a king has to be above a queen. I mean, it would have been really refreshing to have not that not even be an issue.
That's true.
That, of course, if there's a queen and she marries someone, they will either rule jointly or, depending on how your monarchy is established and your rule of heredity and so on, that they would be the consort no matter what their title, and for that to just be. Because even though this is loosely based on a Grecian world, the monarchical structure isn't.
It's so, a lot more feminist than ancient Greece actually was.
Yeah. But I'm saying she has defined her power structure in a way that's not in accordance with how it was if this was going to be an ancient Greece-type world. But it's still following these very established rules of...
It is, but it's interesting. It's this idea that how can he be her husband and not drag her down effectively? Mm. Is him being marked above her or equal to her the only way? And, like, does him being... If he is equal, does that diminish her?
Mm. Well, and part of the issue at stake, too, is that Atolia is beloved, or, well, not necessarily beloved, she's feared in her own kingdom as the queen of her land. Yep. She is not similarly respected by the people of Edis and Sunnis. Yeah. These countries have been at war with each other. So part of the series is the fact that Jen, in his particular relationship to the queen of Edis and now the queen of Atolia, is uniting these three kingdoms. He is in the unique position to unite them. Atolia can't do that.
Which isn't clear to me.
And I guess
the book doesn't make that clear to me.
And that's one of the problems, that we're not getting a lot of this, as I said before.
Now I understand why we go back to Edis. We check in on them, essentially.
That's right, because Edis is crucial.
And now I understand why it's not all told through Costas's eyes, because you need to get all that stuff out. It just does undermine the thing that she was trying to do, the technical thing that she was trying to do, which is smart. And I love the fact that it is domesticated. I like the fact that there isn't a big climactic ending, that there's a sword fight, essentially, with wooden sticks. So, you know, yes, you can be killed by one, but it's not one where...
That is a great sword fight.
She describes it really well, but it's not it's still at the same time... Usually I get annoyed by this, but the stakes are not so high that, it didn't feel high to me anyway.
Okay.
It's about getting respect of the men, which he doesn't even want to do. It's Costas forcing him into that position.
Mm. Yeah, I find it really interesting that, because the whole thing is basically the relationship between, there's the relationship between the king and the queen, which is a minor point of the book actually, and the relationship between Costas and the king.
Yes.
That sword fight is really fascinating because it sort of sums up part of Jen's philosophy, I guess. This whole idea, if you feel fighting, you've got these two cultural exchanges they talk about, where in Atolia, if you're fighting with a wooden sword, you're supposed to pretend that it's a metal sword.
Yeah.
And therefore, you play the rules of honour are to treat it as if it's a metal sword. And then he's like, well, in Edis, it's free-for-all. You just, if you've got a weapon, you use it, whatever.
You're taught to keep track of what weapon is in your hand, whether it's wooden or...
And the fact that this sword fight, the sparring, is actually going to be used as an assassination attempt, and they realise that's happening... I found that really, really interesting because it's that whole thing of like, when it comes down to it, he's a thief. He's always going to cheat. And that thing of like, oh no, is he going to preserve his honour? Oh no, wait, the point in this is not to preserve his honour, it's to stay alive. He did that. And the guy, you know, he's like, he forgot he was holding a wooden sword. Thunk. Yeah. I found that really interesting because it's using a sword fight as metaphor for explaining the character and how the characters interact. But also the whole situation, like really, if you look at the story as Costas' narrative, the big climactic scene is that he's just finally so pissed off at the king. He's just like, you know what, you've been screwing up my life for this entire book. You're going to do something for me. And it's because he gets so offended with his own honour. Because
I thought he was... No, I see, I got the impression he was doing it for the king. Because he has this grudging respect and love for him now, which shat me, I'll be honest, because I thought...
But mostly he was annoyed because of the assassination attempt in which the king saved himself from the assassins, despite only having one hand.
Which no one believed when he...
And then the king... But Costas's own honour was impugned because everybody was now saying, it's this whole thing, if you start becoming a sympathiser to the king, everybody else loses respect for you. So the whole populace hate the king. And then by the end of the book, the king has got the respect of his attendants, who previously hated him, and Costas, who previously kind of hated him, But now everyone's jeering at them because they're supporting the king that no one likes. And he just got so sick of it, so he actually did it for himself.
Yeah, it's right. It's yeah. for his own honor. And then by moving Costas, he moves the man next to him, which is, you know.
Yeah, which is a really slow, painstaking way to invade a kingdom one person at a time.
Well, on that note, we might need to move on. So I guess you and I, Ian, we would say if we were going to recommend people read this book, we would recommend they go back to the beginning.
Yeah, probably. Although I will say
read The Thief and the Queen of Atolia before they continue with this
one. I will
say
one thing, which you may not like, Rebecca, but I'm going to say it anyway, because nothing's ever stopped me. If you want to read, a better Reluctant King narrative, assuming you've only read book three, I think The Goblin Emperor does some similar
stuff.
Oh, The
Goblin Emperor is wonderful, but yeah.
But I think they're doing similar things, though, because they're playing around with this idea of the reluctant person, the reluctant king, the person who doesn't feel they have agency. Yes, obviously there are differences in terms of
I just don't see Jen as not having agency. I see him as deliberately deferring his agency for the sake of for the long game. I always see Jen as having agency.
No, but he doesn't want to be king, though.
Well, yeah, but I mean that's a fight between Jen and the gods, more than anything else.
Okay, all right. Anyway, okay, fine. No, fair point. Yeah. Okay, Goblin Emperor. But anyway, look.
Yeah, Goblin Emperor is great. Everybody read The Goblin Emperor.
Okay, so we're going to move on now to Growing Rich by Faye Weldon, which is a book that Tansy recommended. And Tansy, just briefly, why did you recommend Growing Rich?
Well, I thought a lot about this. It was a lot of pressure because, you know, I've been listening to you guys since the beginning and obviously I had to go to very elaborate lengths for you to have me on as a guest. I decided to choose something that I had read a long time ago and wanted to reread, which, of course, has its inherent risks.
Yes.
But this was a book that I read in my teens. I watched the TV series first, also written by Faye Weldon, and I think I picked up the book almost immediately afterwards. And it was one of those books of a small collection that I loved and reread quite a lot and then haven't for at least like 10, 15 years. So I went back to it. And then I was a little bit scared because I'm like, I've already recommended this to Kirsten and Monty. What if I hate it now? It was a risk. And discovered that actually I still appreciated it very much, but I was actually reading a completely different book than I read in my teens. Like there are a lot of things that are going on. Characters I sympathise with, very different. Yeah, so I found it really interesting. Go back. There's a lot in there I felt to talk about. There's a lot of interesting things that she's doing. Part of the reason I also wanted it to be a Faye Weldon book was I think that she's an author who is in herself really interesting. She does written quite a few spec fic books, but she's also really interesting as a commercial writer. She's mostly seen as a literary author, but she's written, for instance, Lives and Loves of a She-Devil, the Cloning of Joanna May, which is a cloning book about a middle-aged man attempting to replace his wife with the three 20-year-old clones of his wife that he prepared earlier.
It's such a disturbing...
It's the creepiest book ever, but it's also like, you know what, those three clones you made of your wife so you'd have a young, available versions of your wife and three to choose from, yeah, they don't necessarily want you, free will. So, you know, she's written some really interesting spec fic books as well as being known as a mainstream commercial literary writer. And she's done other odd things. She wrote one book which was sponsored by a jewellery company. She's also been a television writer. I think she's a really interesting figure and she's one that I don't often hear talked about in spec fic circles.
Not at all.
At all.
I mean, just shows how narrow I am. I didn't know who Faye Weldon was. Kirsten had to explain it to me. And actually having read this, and I liked it, I didn't love it, but I liked it a lot, I'm wondering why she hasn't been noticed and what's going on there.
It's interesting. I mean, there's probably a lot of literary authors who write the occasional spec fic book and doesn't get necessarily noticed.
They don't live in genre. So,
yeah.
And sometimes,
but it is
in
interesting.
Fact,
like, for instance, you know, she's written several genre books and, you know, they're often just not paid attention to, and I am not sure why, but I think she's one that I've often wanted to wave the flag for because she's written a couple of my very favourite books and she's just a really interesting person.
It's not that I think Faye Weldon is not sleeping at night because she hasn't been nominated for X award.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's okay with it.
Or isn't spoken about in fan communities.
But it's interesting.
But until you came along, Tansy, I mean, I've actually heard of those things you spoke about. I didn't know who Faye Weldon was and didn't know The Attachment.
Well, she's written so much TV. She wrote for, like, Upstairs, Downstairs.
Yes,
she's
written a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I find that interesting when authors aren't... Because when you consider the amount of time and energy people give to discussing whether or not Margaret Atwood is a science fiction writer, and Faye Weldon just, like, coasts on by, and every now and then she writes a book about the devil. But, no, I mean, I think this is an overt fantasy book. I guess there are people who could... This is a layered one. You can definitely see how the literary reader could read it as metaphorical, since you've got the whole unreliable narrative
I think,
thing.
Well, the book kind of explicitly
puts
itself into that zone of ambiguity.
Oh, where, no, it where doesn't. These... He's the devil. Oh, it does not.
Oh, no, I don't Stop think the book it. Is remotely, actually, that ambiguous about whether it's the devil or not, but what it does, it gives you these
We don't know whether the story's real, though.
No, that's true. That is quite
confusing. That's the interesting thing.
He is definitely the devil, but that doesn't mean the book actually exists.
That doesn't mean he's there. Because you've got the, I mean...
I think it is a book that is will be read very differently by different readership.
Yeah.
And that was another thing why I liked about it.
All right.
And found it very interesting. But no, like, the characters I sympathise... Like, I went through and I'm like, okay, I think I remember the characters I sympathised with when I was 15 and reading this book. I no longer sympathise with those characters. You know which character I identify with most? Mrs. Baker, English teacher who is so disappointed. And basically, this book is a horror story about what happens to a 16-year-old girl if she fails her exams.
Yes. Three of them.
Yeah. And it is the horror story of what happens to the English teacher who has the students they're particularly proud of and have particular high hopes that they'll make something of themselves and get out of their small town and maybe do something for themselves. And it's like, ugh. I felt sorry for Mrs. Baker every time she turns up in the story and she's just like, you girls, I just don't know what you're doing. And she's just like...
It is hilarious when one of them quotes Goethe and she goes, oh, you remembered, you know.
Yeah. You're one of these intelligent...
I had some impact.
Women, young women, and they had so much going for them, but this idea... And I think as well, because this is a book, it's set in Fenage, East Anglia. And I love the opening of the book where it talks about how Fenage, East Anglia is basically every small town in every country.
Yes, one of them mentioned hers. Did you notice the mention of Newcastle?
Yes, I did. So I did, and I laughed.
Yeah, there's this idea of, and I think it is actually one of those universal themes. So many people can identify with living in the small town and wanting to get out and knowing how hard it is to do that and actually think, well, actually, maybe that won't happen.
I'm just going to read actually the sentence in there that it did sentence. Make me laugh aloud about being in the small town. It talks a little bit about the town and it says, let the name of the place be Dullesville, Tennessee, or Borup, Denmark, or Newcastle, New South Wales, where I grew up, or Elaine in the United Arab Emirates, or Fenage, East Anglia. A kind of sorrow creeps along the streets and drags you down. You can hardly lift your feet to shake it off.
I think it's interesting as well because this is not a YA book, and this is a book that was published long before the YA train we think of as a marketing term existed.
What is it now packaged as one?
No.
No. But what I'm saying is it's sort of the opposite in the way of the King of Atolia because this is a book about the teenage girl experience, which is written for adult readers, presumably, because it's like a general audience.
Yeah, okay, yep.
So instead of having the YA book about adults, you've got the general audience adult book about the 16-year-old. And I found the 16-year-olds were horribly accurately portrayed to the point where my co-host, Alex from Galactic Suburbia, was pretty sure that she didn't want to read, you know, because she's a teacher. It's like, I think teachers would feel about this book the way that people, mentioning it again, people who work in offices don't want to watch The Office. They don't want to watch, like, TV shows about bureaucracy, or you don't really want to see something too close to you. These are really, like, I remembered being a teenager. No, it wasn't any of those teenagers, but their voices and the way they see the world, and they're so cranky and just, you know, getting in their own way.
And brilliantly, although they grow up throughout the novel, they never actually grow up in, well, this is what I found the point was, their teenage state of mind stays with them throughout the whole novel until some pivotal stuff towards the end.
Well, even by the end, they're still young women. It's not like we see them
grow up. I'm not saying they're crones. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to use that
term. No, but I
don't mean that. I mean, what I mean is that they're obviously growing up, I mean, having kids, etc., you know, falling in love, all those sorts of things.
Still very young.
But they're stuck, in a sense, in that mindset because... For a variety of reasons, both caused by themselves and caused by external influences, such as the devil. But until there are some critical moments towards the end where that sort of changes quite a bit.
Well, it's also the question of poverty and position. Like teenage girls or teenagers who fail their exams and leave school and they don't have any other option, they have to grow up fast in the sense that they go out into the workforce young or have children young. So they are very young women, but they're having to deal with adult experiences before a lot of other teenagers do. Like, there's a big difference between someone who goes off to university, that experience is a bit more sheltered to some extent, again, depending on wealth. And the fact that one of the points of Growing Rich is that their fortunes rise and fall through an outside influence to some extent, or it could be an outside influence, or it could, how much of it is themselves.
Mm.
But things like they lose... the classic YA trope of losing your parents. Things like the safety nets are taken away from them and just that whole thing, entering the workforce, having to deal with a mortgage or a house or children. When they're like, they're babies. They're just like, 17 and 18, 19 through the course of the book. But they are still, they're terribly young to us.
They are terribly young to us.
So young.
Although I think they're about 30 or something towards the end, because Laura's had three or four kids.
I think by the end they're in their late 20s, I think.
She's had four kids, Laura.
No. She has those four kids in about 5 years.
I have to say, as sad as it is, that's a very funny joke that every time we go back to it, I'm pregnant. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's every time the devil decides to screw with her again, it's like, oh, look, another pregnant. And there's this one scene where she's just like, I think, and she's got to the point where she can actually recognise the little tug in her womb. Yeah. She's like, I think I'm pregnant again, and her husband Woody is just like,
No,
you can't. As if it's her, as if she's as the if one who's done
she
it.
She spontaneously became pregnant.
Yeah. Although, ironically, in this book, you wouldn't put it past it. But no, they're actually only about like 23 at most.
Oh, I thought they would have been in the mid to
late. No, because they're like 16, 17 at the beginning.
Maybe
17. Mm. And she does have those, so like the kids are still quite young.
Mm.
They're certainly not even mid 20s yet. But having to deal, they've been dealing with mortgages and jobs and ups and downs and going to New Zealand.
Yeah, oh my God. Oh my God, the New Zealand sections. Oh my God.
Rebecca, what did you think of Growing Rich?
Oh, and the New Zealand sections in particular.
I did not love it. I have great respect for Faye Weldon and what she is trying to do and capable of doing. I never felt that I was in the hands of an unskilled author. I could tell she knew what she was wanting to do, and she was, by gum, she was doing it. I didn't really like what she was doing. I could see sort of all the ingredients of what goes into, a literary novel and the unreliable narrator in this. I found the way the story was told very distancing. I found you have your unreliable narrator who is literally like looking through a window into the lives of these people and in her own mind, like making up large chunks of the plot. Mm. Like, I think this is probably what happened. But then Laura says this and she thinks, whatever. I found the whole thing like, I don't connect emotionally with any of these people. Like, I'm sorry these bad things are happening to you, but I don't really care. I found that almost the way... Almost I found the opposite, I think, of what you found with King of Atolia. I found it too showy and not telly enough in the sense that you get all these bits of dialogue and this is what they say. And I find myself thinking, but how do they really feel about it inside? Like, you have to deduce everything from their behavior, but to a degree where I feel that their emotions are opaque to me and almost in some ways inhuman, that I'm like, shouldn't you be reacting more to this emotionally than you are? Or instead, they just sort of toss off a quip and then go on their merry way. And again, it may be a cultural thing. It may be, I don't even know. But I did find that I was unable to really engage with the story or the characters, and I just kind of went through it. Another big barrier for me, and I will admit my bias in this regard, is I have a serious problem with any books involving angels and devils. My theological background gets in the way, and I'm just like, whatever. I tried to suspend disbelief, for the sake of the story. But, I was the kid that always skipped over the fairy tales about the devil, because I'm like, this is stupid, so I'm not going to read it. So I had to overcome that to get through the book. So, I'm not the right reader for this book, but I can see why other people like it.
That's a big hurdle to overcome, considering the whole book is essentially about a pact with the devil.
Yeah.
It's not a small plot point.
No.
I think for those who haven't read the book, when we're talking about the unreliable narrator, it's the aspect I found most fascinating about it, because the entire story is being told to us by... Is her name Harriet.
Yeah.
Who's a woman who is in a wheelchair.
And I thought she was an old lady for like three quarters of the book.
Yeah, so did I.
An old lady.
Yeah. Especially given her driver is a 90-year-old woman.
Yeah. Yeah. But she actually talks about that she's young, but she feels she's a old young woman. Because she's sort of the invisible woman because she's been in the wheelchair for so long.
So she's either being parked, and that's the word she uses, in front of her own lounge window looking out onto the court where the three girls live, or she is being parked in front of the window at the they change its name several times in the course of the book, but it's a
like a disability support centre. And it's in the town square. So those are the two places she witnesses.
And she's telling this story about what she sees and crucially, as Rebecca said, imagines. So you'll get a scene between two characters and then you'll get Harriet saying, or at least that's what I imagined probably happened. So you have this entire story which is about the devil character trying to tempt Carmen into being part of his Machiavellian plan, and she wants no part of it.
Well, the devil's promised this rich guy to someone else.
Yeah. It's like the devil's
the reward.
Yes.
She's supposed to be the reward for Sir Bernard Bellamy.
Correct.
Because he is basically the Faust character, and his driver, who is the devil, is like trying to tempt him, and he's like, he's given him all this great success, but the one thing he can't provide is Carmen, is the girl, because first of all, he doesn't approve because Sir Bernard Bellamy has, you know, very low tastes, he believes. He wants this random girl he's seen on the street.
Because she has nice legs.
And as it happens, she's a bit bolshy and she won't have anything of it. And so,
because she wants to make her own way in the world and not be indebted to a supernatural being.
And he basically, the devil or the driver, who is referred throughout, flips between trying to tempt her with what he can offer and punish her for not behaving.
Bully her into
And he does agreeing. This not only through affecting her life, but that of her two friends. So he's trying to use the peer thing too. And so alternate terrible and wonderful things happen.
But I found that their life response.
I know we're cutting you off because you were about to make an interesting point about Harriet. But that's the thing that both I loved and annoyed me about the novel, the constant cyclical nature of it.
Yeah.
It feels like I wish this would have been 100 pages shorter or been even a short story, because it's the constant, the driver turns up, he says, you've got to go and marry or even have just a date with Sir Bellamy, you don't have to do anything more than that. She says, yes, I will, and good things happen, but then she dismisses him out of hand because he's a bit of an old coot. And then shit things happen, and then the devil turns up, and then it repeats again. Yeah. And sometimes she won't even have the date with him, and just terrible things happen to her and her friends and anyone connected to them.
Yeah.
And it just repeats and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. Yeah. And while I get why, because it's the whole Mephistopheles thing, and the Book of Job as well, I don't know, it sort of tired on me after a while.
Yeah, I think it did go on a little long. I found it hilarious that the devil is depicted as kind of, because it's not just Sir Bellamy. He's got all these other people that
he's trading favours.
He's juggling all of these packs. And I find he's almost like this mid-level bureaucrat. He's like, well, I promised so-and-so that, but I promised so-and-so that. So if I give that person this thing here and then that person will give me that for this. And it's just like he's almost this hard put upon devil who's trying
to. But at the same time, he doesn't quite understand how people work.
No.
And that's what's kind of fascinating. It's like he certainly hasn't figured out what makes Carmen tick, because really she's too young to even know herself. All she knows is she doesn't want to be pushed around.
Yeah.
Which I sympathise with her so much more than I did when I was a teenager. I just thought she was annoying when I was 15. But as an adult, I'm like, actually, that's the one I want my daughters to grow up to be, the one that questions things. Like, I love the fact that one of the bribes he offers her, for instance, is a beauty in the eye of beholder, which means she looks beautiful depending on what people find attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So her body size is going up and down, and she has to wear her bra held together with a safety pin because her boobs keep going in and out. Her hair keeps changing colour. She doesn't, and she hates it.
She gets shorter and taller.
It's horrible. And she's like, you know, I was okay with how I looked before. And he thinks this is what a teenage girl wants. He thinks she wants to be beautiful. He keeps offering her, like, here is the dream career of your choice, a flight attendant. She's like, well,
I don't want to be a flight attendant.
If I'm going to be a waitress, I might as well do it at the hotel up the road with my friends. And he doesn't get her, and he keeps trying to tempt her. And I found that really interesting, that sort of insight into what's seen as this incredibly powerful male figure, iconically powerful male figure, and he just doesn't get teenage girls.
Yeah.
And that actually is kind of his downfall. Unfortunately,
he doesn't give up. He keeps going. So we get the same.
Because he's the devil.
But what's really interesting is he actually doesn't get people at all, because the whole thing, you know, towards the end, you know, part of the reason of his downfall is he doesn't get Sir Bernard Bellamy either. He's assuming, you know, this is a, you know, aging man who has these particular fantasies. I'm going to fulfill these fantasies. I presume what he wants is sex with a young hot girl. And it's like, well, no, he said he wanted Carmen and stuff like that. As it happens, he's quite happy to, like, wait for marriage. He doesn't actually necessarily want this sort of, I guess, official fantasy that people are supposed to want if they're in his demographic.
Mm.
And just this idea that what the devil has to offer, it's not only just, I guess, a common idea in the folklore figure of the devil, which is that he offers you the thing and it's tainted or it's not as shiny as it looks. But it's like, even the thing he's offering is not necessarily the thing that is going to tempt you, because people have free will and they don't all want the same thing.
And sometimes when you get presented with the thing you think you want, it's like, well, if it's but that easy, point, I don't want it anymore.
My issue is that's points made pretty early on. In fact, it's made again halfway through and it keeps getting made. And your view, Rebecca, that they're a bit opaque. Yeah, I see where you're coming from. You do wonder why. I don't know. Not. I don't want to fall back on agency, because Christ, if we use that term too often. But just, I suppose what was refreshing was when Laura finally says, about two thirds of the way through, essentially, I can't have another kid. Can you just go out with this Bellamy guy already and just sort this thing out, because I'm done. And that's probably one of the most
powerful moments for her.
Yeah, it's powerful and also the most real moments in the book. As much as I love Carmen, because there's something really delightful about Carmen, Laura, in a sense, is possibly the least opaque character, in that I felt she really can't. In that point, she comes off the page because, you know, fuck it, I've got four kids now because of all this. not to say I don't love my kids, because I do love them, da-da-da-da, but just sort this out, because I was at that point too.
I think for me, the character that I identified most with or sympathized most with was Harriet. You know, I'm interested in narratives of disability and so on. And the fact that even though I did think she was an old woman, I found myself more and more in sympathy with her, sort of telling stories to herself, trying to live through these other girls and being sort of continually frustrated and disappointed because, you know, like, if only she had the chance to get out there and live life. And then to find sort of midway through that she's got kind of a crush on Driver. You know, and that so she's kind of almost fantasizing the interactions with him that she would like to have, you know. And so she becomes this much more complex and interesting character as the novel unfolds, as opposed to just a narrative device. And I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I found that was the most fascinating thing about the book for me, was that choice of having an explicit narrator, because the book just could have been told without Harriet as a character, and this could have just been the way the story was told. But to have an explicit narrator in the book who is physically merely a watcher, because of her physical situation, she cannot interact a lot with the people she's telling the story about. She's watching. That's what she's doing out of one of two windows. And I don't know, the more I think about this book, the more I do not read this as actually happening. I read this as Harriet's construction of the world she's seeing and trying to make it more interesting. So looking at what's happening in this little village.
But also trying to make it make sense.
And make sense.
Because these ups and downs and the good, and you know, the whole thing of like, oh, kids today, you know. You know, the fact that these are the three most promising students and they end up failing their exams.
Yeah, it's like, how has that happened?
She explains, you know, she has this, and it's this bizarre thing, like there's this whole weird subplot with Annie's mother who has Count Kapinski living in her head because she's like the local medium. And
Count
the reason
Kapinski.
That the local medium is so
who
important
is responsible for
is
the girls failing the exams.
The one doctor in town has gone a bit off the rails and doesn't believe in modern medicine anymore. So everyone goes to the local medium to get their, like, treatment. And then she's got this ghost in her head, and the whole thing of, like, they fail. It's really interesting. They failed their exams, and even though they're like, this is the one thing that's terrible in their lives that is in no way down to the driver. They failed their exams because Count Kapinski is like, oh, I know all. And they're like, well, can you tell us what are the exam questions? And he tells them these perfect, believable exam questions, and they just study for that, and they all flunk out because he was just.
But there is a link implied between Count Kapinski and the devil in the latter part of the book.
So that could even be
the devil.
And certainly at one point he comes back.
Yes.
And it's like, it's good luck that he's gone, it's bad luck that he's back. But yeah, maybe these weird things happen to this girl. It's like, well, the only explanation for how Laura could possibly be pregnant again is because, oh, look, there's the driver back in town and, you know. Yeah.
Well, and those passages you mentioned about New Zealand. The interminable passages about New Zealand.
And they invented bungee jumping, which I actually didn't know. Yep. Do you know they invented bungee jumping?
Yes, everyone knows that.
Yes. Oh. What comes through in those passages to me is Harriet's longing to be in New Zealand, like this desire to get out of where she is and to be in this place which she has clearly researched exhaustively because she is sharing all these facts with the reader. You know, and so she is like desperate to live the life that Annie is living, you know, sort of thing, going to New Zealand.
But it also kind of interrogates against the thing of what people are supposed to want versus what they actually want. Like, Annie is basically given this fantasy of an English girl in a small town, of like this, the heroic kind of shiny, wealthy boyfriend who takes her off to an exotic place and turns out, you know, he's terribly wealthy and all this stuff. And it's just so, like, irritating, a lot of it. And she's just like, you've all got all this money and you just care about sheep. And he works and so hard, and they just spend the whole time calling her a whinging pom. And she's just like, you know, I've been scrubbing potatoes till my hands bleed and you made me learn how to make a pavlova and I'm just over
this. And then there's that wonderful line where her fiancé, was it after the bungee jumping or some other thing that he's had her do, which is horrendously physically excruciating for her, and he sort of turns to her and says, I'm really proud of you. You've learnt not to whinge so much.
That really got to me.
Oh, my God.
Was that unpunchable? Oh, as an Australian child with a slightly English accent, I have a nervous twitch about the whole whinging pom thing because it was horribly used as a bullying tactic when I was a child.
I felt like just throwing the book.
I know.
Not because I was angry at the book, but like she conveys these characters so well, and you end up getting so frustrated with them.
Yeah.
So I think I've come down deciding that this is not a book that's literally a pact with the devil, and that this is all Harriet's. Because when she goes,
because her reading material,
and she goes to the US.
What did you buy? Her reading material in the home
influences what happens.
Yes. Yeah.
And also, when she goes
to the States a couple of times to have surgeries, and nothing happens during that time because she's obviously busy doing medical things and has too much to think about in her own life. But she never relays blow by blow what happens there. So her own life is so obviously so perhaps not a disappointment to her, but certainly it doesn't have everything that she wants.
Can I ask, how is Harriet explained in the TV series?
She's not. That's the fascinating thing.
She's not there.
Because I remember when I borrowed the book, and as people in the audience can see, it's a very attractive picture based on a still from the TV series. And as soon as I borrowed it from the library, I was like, oh, I remember watching that. Yeah. And I did watch it when it first came out. It was on the ABC.
In 92. So you were what, 28?
And I... 19.
You were 19.
Okay, all right. I forgot. I can't remember my age once I got past 35.
I'm just saying, you were even allowed to watch it.
I now have to calculate. So I remember watching it, and I had to actually go back, and it's on YouTube now if anyone's interested. Someone's put it up on YouTube to go back to see, because I didn't remember Harriet at all. And it's because she's not there. This narrator is completely invented for this novel version of the story. And it's
and there's
just
that whole question
fascinating.
Of, it is, because it gives it a completely different shape. Mm. And the comparison I was going to make was there is a Doctor Who novelisation, The Myth of the Mythmakers, and they had the thing with the novelisations of the Doctor Who stories, but they'd sometimes, like, the writers would take some weird liberties. And that one, this Doctor Who story is narrated by a man who loses his sight through the course of the story and is revealed to be Homer.
Yes.
So basically, it is a Doctor Who novelisation in which the story of Troy and the Doctor at Troy is narrated
by Homer.
Homer, who is like seen to be a character who appeared very briefly and didn't speak in the story. He was like there was like a death of a spy episode in which a character is like, he was like, no, I wasn't killed, I was just wounded, and this is what I did for the rest of the book, or for the rest of the story. So it really takes so many liberties, and this has this odd thing as well of like providing a narrator.
I will
that
say,
wasn't in the series.
Even though I really enjoyed reading the book, the ending just, I hated the ending. I hated it so much. It felt like
And the TV series has the same ending?
You know, I didn't watch everything that was on YouTube, so I can't remember. But I think it basically has.
The TV series came first.
Yes. They came out pretty much concurrently as far as I'm aware. Like, I'm pretty sure that, I mean, I don't know which she wrote first. It may be one. It was probably the TV series, but she may have written them concurrently.
Yeah.
She was very well known as a TV writer. And this isn't the first time, because with Big Women, another of her things, the book and the TV series came out pretty much at the same time.
Okay.
So I don't really know her working methods, whether she wrote the book and the screenplay and which came first. But again, that's one where there are differences in the book and difference in the TV series. But obviously they wanted to do both and they brought the book out with the TV series.
Yeah. From memory, the TV series ends pretty much the same in that
And it's much more explicitly fantastic, of course. And Robin Hood from Maid Marian and the Merry Men plays Ronnie Cartwright, who is, you know, the love of Carmen's life.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, completely, you know, just like gormless smile all the way through.
What did you think of the ending, Tansy?
It's interesting. No, I don't particularly love it. I'd actually forgotten a lot of stuff about it. I mean, the whole thing of, like, the Carmen and Bernard Bellamy actually getting together is a little bit...
That was really disappointing to me.
But also, I didn't mind the idea that they decided that that Bernard Bellamy didn't just want to have a one-night stand with Carmen.
No,
and that
like
Carmen
that.
Decided, actually, he was quite an interesting person.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I didn't have a copy of the contract.
It comes down to the magical powers of virginity, which is problematic in many ways.
But they still, like, how did it matter whether they had sex before or after they got married that meant it violated the devil's pact? Because according to what the devil promised Sir Bellamy, he got Carmen. And according to what Carmen promised the devil, she had sex with Sir Bellamy at some point.
But she hadn't
because she gets pregnant.
No, because she wasn't. But she wasn't pregnant when his downfall was caused.
No, they hadn't had sex. No. But I just don't see, like, there wasn't, like, a timeline for the devil to make this happen. So doesn't he actually still win?
Yeah, I think there's almost this implication that it was the thing of, I guess, I think it comes down to sexual morality, which is, it's very old, and I know it's written in the early 90s, but, you know, it was quite old-fashioned even then.
Yeah, I did not like the ending because it just didn't seem to make sense to me. That how it ended with them getting married instead of him just having a one-night stand with her meant that
it didn't end with them getting married, though. I mean, his downfall happened before, didn't it?
They're married and she's pregnant at the very end.
Yeah, but that's after the driver has kind of been driven away.
Oh, sure, but that's what I mean. Why doesn't the driver get to come back and go, well, now you've all fulfilled the things and I have your souls, ha ha ha.
No, I think he was already beaten and he went away. I don't know. It's sort of built up as this.
I didn't get it at all.
It was disappointing and it felt like one of those books where, and I'm not saying this was the case because she may have had this ending in mind and written to it from the very beginning, but it felt as a reader like there was this book which was going on and going on and then suddenly you realise you've got to get to an end and you have no idea how to end
it. Well, no, because there's only two ways it can end, essentially.
The devil wins or the devil loses.
Correct. And Carmen...
Sure. But the way he lost, supposedly, just doesn't seem to...
No, it comes out. It doesn't even come out of the blue. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And happens very quickly.
Which is a shame. I really wanted this to end well, and it still could have ended either with the devil winning or losing. But it just the way that was orchestrated just.
And I wonder partly if it's the visual thing where it has a very cinematic, almost like you've got the big dramatic cinematic kind of confrontation, and there's lots of. Terribly meaningful things being said, and I think it's almost like it's the power of belief for the parent, and that's when it gets a bit weebly.
It was a shame.
I didn't love the ending so much, and that was the part I didn't remember. Like, I remember all the stuff of the girl's friendship and all the kind of the ups and downs and the character stuff, which I find really interesting throughout. And I didn't remember the ending. Yeah. It's not very memorable.
You remembered Count Kapinski, didn't you?
it's hard to forget Count Kapinski.
I just love the name, Count Kapinski. I mean. And the fact that he's living contemporaneously with them, so when he dies, apparently she loses the connection because he's stuck in a 14th century prison.
So it's like she's telepathically connected to this guy in a prison cell in the 14th century. And she's so serious about it. And the thing that Annie is just like constantly like...
And this is Annie's
not
mother.
Not sure if her mother is actually making it up because she's really committed to it. But also the weird relationship between Annie's parents and Count Kapinski where he's just like... he's this really serious ambulance driving dude and he's just like, and here I am sharing my wife with Count Kapinski. And it's just...
Very quirky.
There's a lot of quirky characterizations. Quirky. Yeah. It's talking about the unreliable parents. They're terrible parents.
They're the worst parents. The dad that comes back with Poison Poppy.
The one,
oh, my God. And we haven't even started on Poison Poppy. We've got to finish.
We can't. Because unfortunately, we're recording live, we've had our five-minute warning. So we're going to wrap it up.
Sure we can't spend 5 minutes on Poison Poppy?
No.
Okay.
So thank you to Tansy and Rebecca for being our guests and bringing us lovely books to talk about. And thank you for the people in the audience for coming along. It's always a delight to talk to people who are not just walls in someone's house or in Ian's imagination. Next episode, I am in my ongoing endeavour to recommend more Australian books, even if I somewhat tangentially know the authors and get intimidated by talking about books by people I know. I am recommending The Godless by Ben Peake.
Which you haven't read.
Which I have not read. It's off the to-be-read pile.
So,
but I have read other stories in the world that Peake has set The Godless in, which I've really enjoyed. And I read
end,
a lot.
This could end terribly.
It could end terribly, but I trust this author to not write a book I will actively hate. Let's put it that way. I may not be totally in love with it by the end, but I'm pretty sure I won't hate this book. I'll have a lot of interesting things to say about what I'm sure is a very interesting book. And Ian, what are you recommending?
I am recommending this year's Philip K. Dick Award winner, which a book I fell in love with and I've spoken quite a bit about elsewhere, which is The Book of the Unnamed Midwife by Meg Ellison. It's another, I apologise, Kirsten, it's another post-apocalyptic thing.
Oh.
Well, it's another virus book. It's another book where the virus has wiped out humanity. However, a wonderful counterpoint to Station 11.
Okay, this is your ongoing endeavour to get me to constantly talk about Station 11 on every episode.
Yes, on every episode. Okay. How this will be, I promise, the last book that involves something wiping out humanity and the last stragglers trying to survive. Because frankly, I hate those books as well, so I don't know why I'm recommending
them. I don't hate them. They just have higher and higher hurdles to jump over every time I read
them. I think this one's astonishing.
Okay.
And short. Because I'm always thinking of how, you know, you've got the PhD and you shorter books. It's very short.
I thank you for that.
Thanks. Yeah, okay. Good. Well done.
So you can send us feedback by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, emailing us at writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, where you mostly get Ian, and we are at writerandcritic there. Or do you even care anymore about iTunes ratings, Ian? Have you given up that?
iTunes? Does that still exist?
Okay, there we go. Yeah. Leave us a rating on iTunes if you listen and like what you hear.
And thank you, Carol, for tweeting us earlier today about how she's binged it and she's from Ireland.
Excellent. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Yeah, bye. 'Cause we pretend, this is partly true, but I do pretend in my head that there's an audience. So I do act this way consistently.
Yeah,
during
he does.
The other podcasts.
You do.
It must be really annoying.
Fuck it is. Often her. Yeah.
It's worse when he takes questions.